My name is Ron Weber, and I'm 14 years old. Today is November 22nd, 2018, and I'm speaking with Susan Glantz, who is our close family friend. We're recording this interview in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. So the first question is, I just want to figure out, how did you meet my mom?
We have a mutual friend named Susie Puig, and she introduced us on Kauai. And from then on, the three of us were pretty much the Musketeers.
All right. And how did you end up in Hawaii?
I got stuck in L.A.
Uh-oh.
High density living. I had to make an exit plan. And Kauai, I had been there a couple of times, always had good memories. And it was just a more kickback way of life and not high density. So a man hired me the week before Hurricane Iniki, 1992. And then the hurricane happened 1 week later. So I waited 2 years and then I came over and accepted the job. With my son, who was your age at the time.
Oh, wow. And what was the job exactly? It was like...
It was timeshare.
Timeshare.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Here's just kind of a fun question. Did you ever have a nickname? And if so, how did you get it?
Well, the first nickname I ever had was Susie Q. And my dad gave it to me because he gave all my sisters and brothers nicknames, which were kind of entertaining. My sister Sandy's name was Sassafras. My sister Bonnie was Bonnie Boops. I was Susie Q. My brother Chris was number one son. And my youngest brother Rob was Robert Auberdo. And I was Susie Q.
There you go. So tell me where you grew up and what your childhood was like.
I was born in San Francisco, third generation. Post-World War II child, 1950. Then we had the little cute house in the East Bay on Drew Street, which happens to be my dad's name and my son's name. And then my dad got transferred into Sacramento, north of Sacramento. We bought a house in Fair Oaks on a creek. And we thought it was country living. We had like 19 oak trees and a creek, and we were loving it, loving that.
Yeah?
Yeah. Then we went to, my mom was raised Catholic. Her brother was a Catholic priest. My brother Rob Dabardieu was named after him. He was an army chaplain in World War II, featured in the book, The Devil's Brigade, and then the movie with William Holden. But we went to an Irish Catholic parochial school there in Fair Oaks with nuns that had been off the boat for 2 weeks from Ireland. And they were horrific.
Oh, man.
I mean, ugly.
Horrific in that they were just...
They were unkind. And they had many... They did not show the joy of the Lord, that's for sure.
Do you remember a specific time in which that was shown?
Yeah, the day I left, I'd had it. 4 years of that, kept telling my mother. She didn't catch on. The nun was, I don't know if she was menopausal or what, but I'd been on the school grounds, I was 12, and I'd been on the school grounds for not even 5 minutes, and she came up those stairs like a bat out of hell and had that Irish brogue working overtime and did the, Miss Glantz, you're as bold as brass. And then she just started boxing my ears with her knuckles and put me in the first grade classroom and had me kneeling on the cement doing the rosary and wanted me to ask forgiveness for what I had done. And I had to respond, Sister, I don't know what I've done except for show up for school. And then... I had a girlfriend named Susan Chrisman. Our dads were best friends. And she got put there too. And then when the nun came back in to get us, Susan Chrisman just hugged her around the legs and begged forgiveness for doing what? I have no idea. And so she let her go. Oh, Susan Crisman, you're a good girl, don't you know? You can be excused. And I yelled, looked at Susan Crisman in the eye and said, Benedict Arnold! That was it. The friendship was over. So that was my escape from St. Mel's. When I came home that day, oddly enough, my father was home. He was never home when I got home. And I came in the front door and he said, reading the paper, feet up on the coffee table, Susie, how are you? What are you doing? I said, I'm horrible. And my voice was quivering. And I said, I was from the era you never talked back to your parents or any adult. So I said, I'm never going back to that school and nobody can make me. Sister Rosario abuses us on a regular basis. Mom doesn't do anything about it. I'm done. And my dad ran out the front door in his bedroom slippers and told my mother, Virginia, get him on the phone. And then she denied the whole thing. So I told my mother, I said, you know, they say one thing and then they're full of hypocrisy. And then you send us there and you pay money to do it. They're a bunch of liars. I'm out of there. So anyhow, that was the end of my Catholic school upbringing.
Wow.
I got an education that I was not enjoying. I was learning just how horrible people could be.
Mm-hmm. Well, you touched on this a little bit, but one of the questions was going to be, tell me about your parents.
Oh, well, my mom was one of five. My dad was one of three. My mother was born in San Francisco, down west of the marina. She had eldest brother, Uncle Rob, who we mentioned, the priest. And then Aunt Helen, Aunt Mary, then my mother, and then Uncle Bill. Now, my grandmother, Nana, we called her Nana. Their last name was Essig. It's German for vinegar, Essig. She met my grandfather married when she was 28. And that day you were considered a spinster, an old maid, if you were 28 and not married. But she was the last of 11 children to live because they all died early, high fatality rate. And she went sailing on a Sunday with a friend and her father who was in the Navy, and they made it to Treasure Island, which is under the Bay Bridge, the San Francisco Bay Bridge. And they met some sailors there, and knowing that her father was, you know, like a captain, he introduced them and they became friends. And my grandfather, William Essig, started courting her. He joined the Navy when he was 14 in New York. He lied and said he was 16 to get on there. But I have a photo of him, like, on the scope of a submarine. 3 men. It was a naval recruiting poster.
Wow.
He was a neat guy. Anyhow, they stayed married for years, but she pretty much had birthed five children pretty much on her own. And because my grandfather was always in what they used to call a U-boat, a submarine, under some ocean somewhere. And my mom, grandmother was birthing and raising babies on her own. And the last one, Uncle Bill, I think she had what they call postpartum depression, which they didn't have a tag name at that time, but she kind of had a little breakdown. So he had to come home. And so my mom went to school there in San Francisco, hiked those hills all the time. My mom, at 92 years old, had the best legs, from ankles to hips, from hiking all those hills all the time. But after my grandmother's little episode, they moved to East Bay because my grandfather decided he wanted to get her away from immediate family, thought that was too much pressure on her. So they moved to the East Bay. But the place that they lived west of the marina was very interesting because as a kid, when you used to sit around the dining room table and listen to Uncle Rob the priest, who had a parish in Campbell, which is San Jose, California, would they talk stories. And they tell all these ghost stories. And as a kid, I'm very interested in this. This seems very interesting. Because he'd say he was in the basement of the house, you know, west of the marina. And he'd be down there helping my grandfather tinker on stuff. They were tinkers. They could just make anything. They're the type that you could give them a Q-tip and a paper clip and they would build them all. They could just make anything from anything. They were very mechanically inclined. So he'd hear noises upstairs and he'd tell my grandfather, "Dad, I think the girls are home." And my grandfather would keep working on whatever he was working. He goes, "No, they're not home yet." And then they had those huge wooden doors that were pantry doors, like they cut off the kitchen area from the dining room. And those things would sometimes would just slide open and closed on their own recognizance. And pie tins would go flying through like Frisbees. So, you know, as a kid, this is very intriguing business. So anyhow, they eventually moved out of that house, but they had a lot of interesting experiences there, and those are just a few.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, let's see. So tell a funny story from when you were growing up.
Well, there was a lot of them. We were always laughing a lot because you had five kids running around. But one kind of fun story that pops into mind was with my dad. My dad was very charming and gregarious and tall with dark blonde hair and a wave here and hazel eyes. And he was born outside of Helena, Montana, but raised on Green Street off of, was it Union Lake in Seattle area? So he joined the Navy at a young age. And he met my mother at the Presidio in San Francisco. So, I don't know, just fun things. Like we're all in the front room watching TV and my dad would just be very theatrical and pop out of the hallway and just start singing songs and doing all these theatrical gestures and making us all laugh. He made us laugh a lot. So, you know, I think that's normal until you go to other people's houses and their parents are boring. But my parents always had season tickets for decades to the theater in San Francisco. Them and three other couples would always rendezvous there. And they saw some great, great stuff. That was just one cute little funny story, but...
Yeah, no.
Here's another one. There was the year that my dad was out of work and he hated being out of work because all men like to be providers for their family. And back in the day, you had those phones that hung on the wall. And they had the plastic kind of cover. And then you had a cord from the receiver to the wall, to the phone. And the whole encasement kept falling onto the receiver that would... That's how you hung up the phone. And it irritated my dad. He kept trying to pop it back on. And I'm cooking dinner. My mom's not home from work yet. And it was a long, skinny kitchen, but it was wider than this one and twice as long. And so I'm cooking dinner. My dad's messing with the phone. And it's making me a wreck because he's getting irritated. So before I know it, he's like, cursing and there's a bunch of noise and I turn around. He's yanked the phone right off the wall. There's a hole in the sheetrock. And I'm like, I'm shaking. And then I'm just a wreck. And then I'm supposed to go out that night. It's a Friday night. And my girlfriends call me and the phone's ringing, but there's wires hanging out of a hole in the sheetrock. It's just like, holy crap. So anyhow, I don't know what to do. And then I have to sprint to the other end of the house all the way around to get the phone, and it's my girlfriend. What's going on? Gee, I don't know. My dad's upset. My mom's not home. And, you know, maybe we'll get to go out. Maybe we won't. Then I'm back in the kitchen cooking dinner. My mom comes home and I give her the whole story as I always did with high drama because I had the flair for the drama. So I go, now Dad disappeared. I don't know where he is. So we finish dinner, set the table, get it all on there. And my dad pops in. Well, he'd gone over to the neighbors to release steam, have a little cocktail. And he comes back in and, oh, in the middle of me cooking the dinner, the phone rings again. I got to run all the way around the house again and answer. It was right after he yanked the phone out of the wall within less than 10 minutes. And I pick up the phone and I go, hello. And they go, hi, this is the phone company. We understand you're having problems. And I'm thinking, what is this? Big brother? How do they know? How do they know? And so, yes, we are. What's exactly the problem? I don't know what to say. I don't want to get my dad in trouble. Well, it's just not working well. I mean, I don't know how to respond to this question. Okay, well, we'll be out in an hour. Well, do you have to come so early? Can't you come tomorrow? I start saying, because I need to talk to my parents before that. Oh, no, we'll be out in an hour. So then my mom comes home, I tell the story. My dad pops in the door, the table's set. We put on the dinner, we're all eating. Knock, knock, knock on the front room door. And who is it? It's the telephone company. I'm just like shaking my boots. I'm a wreck. My dad just pops up off the table, stands up, invites the guy in the door. Hi, come on in. Have a seat. Have you had dinner? You're working kind of late. We make him a plate. The guy sits down and says, thanks. And my dad just says, hey, here's the deal. The phone was broken. It wouldn't stay on the wall. I had a little meltdown. I ripped it right out of the wall. Who'd have thunk it? The guy just was blown away, started laughing because my dad was so frank and he was so honest about it. So he fixed the phone without, like, you know, getting my dad in trouble, got him a new phone. My dad made a little plaque the next day to put the phone on through the hole in the wall and had a little hook on there for a notepad with a pen. It all worked out, but it just was one of those interesting times around the Glantz household. Mm-hmm. Drew in action.
That was great. So this is another one I think will be fun. If you could relive your teenage years, would you?
Yeah, I'd probably do things a little bit differently, but...
But you say you would?
Yeah.
Do you know, like, what things you would do differently?
I probably wouldn't be so tolerant of my sisters. I don't know. I kept pretty busy. I tried to get good grades. I worked. Bought my own car with my sisters. I don't know much else that I would do different. Factor in just who I was, a very naive, follow the rules, always ask permission kind of girl. That's all I can think of. I mean, I might have been, you know, 14 through 17, but I was very go by the rules kind of girl, you know? That was it.
All right. Now, this is a question I thought would be very interesting. What advice would you give to future generations?
Know God.
Could you maybe elaborate?
Yes. In this day and age, I heard this 30 years ago from Chuck Swindoll, who's a famous preacher. But what he said is totally unfolded and come true. You cannot protect your children from the world in this day and age. I mean, we have Instagram. Everybody's communicating instantly around the planet. And, you know, we live in very interesting times. But if your children are steeped in the Lord, then they can protect themselves and not get sucked into bad situations. They can just turn it around. They'll have the knowledge and the confidence to remove themselves. And when things are really tough, they'll press into the Lord because they know Him. See, when I went to parochial school, like I said, it was very hypocritical. Then when I went to a Christian church and really got into the Bible, because we only knew a very small part of the Bible, we didn't know the whole story, then you know that God can protect you and help you. He is your Father. And that's how you insulate yourself pretty much from trouble, because it's going to be everywhere. It's just the choices that you make, you know? So sometimes you just got to take a breath, step back, pray to the Lord and follow what He says no matter what, because that's how He protects you, is when you stay close to Him and then you're obedient. And I did not learn that in a Christian school. But that is the biggest and the only piece of advice that, you know, I have.
Yeah. That was great. Now, tell me about one of the most important people in your life.
My first mother-in-law, Eleanor Lynn, was so kind to me. And I was very close with she and her husband, Phil. And they really, really unconditionally loved me. They prayed for me all the time, you know, which I really didn't know about, but they were parents you could sit and talk to. And they would really tell me about their experiences with the Lord and how the Lord would talk to them. And I just trusted her and respected her so much, I would really sit and listen to that woman. And I really, really know in my heart that Eleanor and Phil were strategic in my walk with the Lord. You know, they were a huge influence, and they weren't overly, you know, doting on me about it, but you know, I would just go over there all the time, and she and I would talk, and when she told me the day that God told them to leave their church they're in, and then they sat in their bedroom together and prayed, and He told them another church to go to by name and the address. See, I'd never heard of that before, and I was 23, 24 maybe. And I just really paid attention. And one time she paid for me to go on a huge Christian woman's retreat. And it ended up that was the kind of church I ended up getting into, that was like a Bible church of the Lord. No dogma like the Catholics or the Presbyterians or all that, with rules that weren't really out of the Bible. And I completely look forward to seeing her again. You know? Like a second set of parents I had for a short period of time. They were a complete blessing. I can see her face to this day. And oddly enough, you know, I kind of lost touch with them, raising my son and living in different places, but I knew when she died. I felt it. Somehow God's given me that thing when I've had people die close to me. I feel something about, I'm thinking about them really hard for a few days or a week, and then I learn that they passed away. And then she was a huge, that's happened about 8 or 10 times. So then you catch on that, you know, this is a, you know, a sign of something big going on. But I'd say Eleanor Lynn first comes to mind, a dear, dear person.
Wow, that's a really great story. And lastly, I'd like to finish it off on a lighter note.
Mm-hmm.
Describe your favorite Thanksgiving memory.
Oh my gosh. Now this is something else, and it was... eight years ago. And it may sound odd that it wasn't with my own family, because that was always chaos. And since I lived away from my family so much, I historically for decades have put on what I call orphan Thanksgivings, Easters, Christmases, made the big meal, invited all kinds of people over, because I just can't stand having people alone on these holidays. But my only son, Drew, was married. Their eldest daughter, Abigail, was 6 months old. It was a super bad winter with all kinds of weather. And I flew in, and I'm the type that wants to know what's going on way before it goes down when it comes to a big holiday or something. Otherwise, I get edgy. Well, anyhow, Drew just didn't know, because they had to drive all the way from Spokane all the way to Seattle and then over to Vashon Island. So I was in Sacramento, flew up to SeaTac, and it was like the day before Thanksgiving. I think it was a couple of days. It was like November 18th or something. Pure sun and all kinds of snow. Now, this area may get snow, but Seattle here in SeaTac, they don't get snow like we do over here. So it was just epically gorgeous. And I kept calling Drew and Renee, like, okay, where are we going? What are we doing? Well, we were going to go to Renee's family's house, but, you know, they're all snowed in over there, and it froze up, and the water's not running, and the electricity's out. And I'm thinking, what? You know, I'm like, what's going on? I'm all aggravated. So anyhow, finally, about the sixth call in two or three days about this, I said, Drew, I don't care if we get together at Big Mac's. I want to sit with you and your wife and that baby and have a meal. So he goes, don't worry about it, Mom. We're driving over the pass tonight, which made me a wreck that they're driving over the pass at night with the baby. But he had to get off work. The baby won't sleep unless it's nighttime and she's just in the car. So they know what they're doing. I had to trust them. And then they stayed at night at a friend's house, and they call me at Drew's godfather's house, who happened to be a guy that I went to St. Mel's with. He was in fifth grade, I was in fourth grade, and somehow this connection has kept. He went to Jesuit high schools. I mean, he had a good education, then he fell into harm's way, but he pulled himself out of it. So they picked me up. Okay, Mom, we're on our way over. We got it all planned out, it's all good. So they pick me up. We take pictures with the darling baby Abigail. And he goes, Ryan, who's his brother-in-law, Renee's brother, his in-laws, Izzy's parents, have all invited us to their place on Whidbey Island. They've got plenty of room for everybody. Well, you know, you've heard that a few times in your life, but you never really know what it's going to mean. Okay, does that mean I'm going to be sleeping in a sleeping bag on the floor and we're going to have sandwiches and we're all going to be squeezed in? Well, only time will tell. So we all get in the car, and it's kind of like we caravan to this northern point of western Washington called, I don't know, it started with an M, it was an Indian name. But it's a ferry stop. And then there's her parents in the car, there's the brother-in-law, there's the younger sisters. It's like we got a parade or a caravan going on. So we missed the ferry by two cars. Well, the baby's young, you know, Abby's 6 months, so Renee's in the back seat with the baby in case she has to nurse her. I'm riding shotgun. I'm navigating with the directions Drew's driving. So we get to the place, we get on the island, and we're in Whidbey Island, and we're driving, and I go, oh, this is it. And it's huge. the land is huge. Right directly adjacent to them is like a 10-acre lavender farm. These people have a big house, like huge log cabin. And by that, I mean like 6,000 square feet log cabin with like a 6-car garage. You know, it's like Robin Leach Northwest style. So Renee tells me to leave something, just leave your stuff in here. Well, I was trained, you never waste a trip, you take it in. So I take it in. And the place is just like, inside my head, all the music's going off because it's Thanksgiving, but it's completely decorated for Christmas. Huge table for like 15 people, all decked out to the nines. Huge Christmas tree, Santa's village, the nutcrackers. I'm like, heaven, I'm in heaven. I'm loving this. So I leave my stuff at the front door and I've got the baby in my arms when Ryan, you know, Renee's brother, comes up and goes, oh, Susan, I'll take your stuff up to your room. Oh, okay, thank you. Well, later I get up to my room. It's huge. There's a piano in it. The sister comes in and she starts playing Christmas tunes. Before you know it, we're all standing around singing Christmas songs. I just think I have died and gone to heaven. And then you can look out and see the Puget Sound with the big ships going by. There's the Cascades. We're in the rain shadow. That's why the beautiful lavender farm grows lavender so well. And then we sit at the table. These people are Christian. He's a doctor. The wife's a nurse. The two twin sisters that live in the huge studio apartment above the 6-car garage are nurses. And he is a Gideon. Do you guys know the Gideon Bible? They have them in every hotel room everywhere. Well, the Gideons are really quite a group of people. And he just came back from, Izzy's father just came back from a huge Gideon convention. And he's got a small basket of mini Bibles on the table and he passes them out. And he goes, you know, I'd like to go around the table and speak about individually what everybody's thankful for. Well, that was easy for me. And then in the front of the little mini Gideon, but take as many as you want. I took three. You open it up and if you're sad, if you're this, if you're that, you just go to this verse in the Bible. I thought this was brilliant because that's what people need. And so when it got to me, I said, well, you know, it's easy for me to say, and I'm fortunate that I'm number three on this tell what you're thankful about, but obviously I'm just thankful to be here with you folks on this beautiful Thanksgiving where you just happen to have room for us all. We all had separate suites with our own bathrooms. And come on, a bedroom big enough to have a piano in there. We had five people around singing and this huge post bed. It was just like over the top. And I said, I'm thankful for Abigail. She's my first grandchild. She's healthy. She's beautiful. Drew and Renee are healthy. I'm just so thankful to be here and that you people would be so kind to invite us into your home. So it was just great. Then I'm walking around there. And, you know, I've come over from Kauai. I'm used to being hot. Now I'm like cold, but I had a lot of clothes on. I kept peeling things off. Took the boots off, had on the wool socks. Thought, man, I'm still hot. Well, I found out they had one of those polished cement floors. I didn't know that people put heaters in those floors at that time. So that's why I was getting warm. Then he had the father was so interesting. He had the whole rundown on how the whole house was made. So I was totally intrigued with that. And then the next day we got to go to the lavender farm and smell things and get things, and then they've got a paddock and Izzy's riding the horses, and they have this huge island in the middle of the kitchen all with pounded out copper, and all these girls, the daughters, were fabulous cooks, and we're just sitting there, you know, all these people from Apple and whatever that are based up there, they all have huge houses up there, and we can look out on the Puget Sound and see ships and boats go by. I gotta say, and that was only a few years ago, that was really memorable to me. People were nice, people of God. And then he told us this story about the head speaker at the Gideon Convention, which is international. And it was a Frenchman who was over here going to school. He was really depressed. He was sleeping in a dumpster. He was ready to drop out of school. And somebody was passing out those little Gideon Bibles. And some people keep them and find them valuable, and other people chuck them. Somebody chucked it, and it hit the guy in the head while he was sleeping in the dumpster. And it woke him up. And he opened that Bible and read it, and it changed his life. Now he was the head of an international corporation. He was French, and he was the lead speaker at this Gideon Convention. It was just, he had just come back that day. The next day, they had to go shopping for their five kids, for their daughter that lived in Israel. And they had to, like, pick them all up, shoes and everything. They were headed out 2 days later to go to Israel, which I eventually made it to. But that was very memorable to me.
I can certainly see why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you thought that dinner was great the next morning, the whole breakfast. It was like, I'm never leaving here. I like this place. They live next door to the lavender farm. We got the view. It was fabulous, yeah. That was really fun. I should write them that sometime, Izzy. They're the ones that are at Drew and Renee's house today and tomorrow and the next day. Yeah, Izzy and Ryan. Yeah, then we all had to like caravan it back to Vashon Island in Paradise Cove, and up the water still wasn't working, and her dad was on the, you know, he was second man in the neighborhood to know how to turn all that on. He didn't know how. Yeah. But for 2 days, it was really, wow. I got my own room with the bathroom, with the piano, everybody's singing, the food's great. Yeah. I thought I was going to be sleeping on somebody's floor. I was up for it as long as I got to see everybody.
All right, well, thank you, Susan, very much. It's really cool to hear your stories.
Those I have in abundance.
Yes.